Hello and welcome. This is Nancy reading with you this afternoon from the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette. Today is Wednesday, April 26, 2017. We'll begin with our main headline on the front page. It's news from the University of Illinois. The headline is Diverse Ideas. Report: Campus Should Unify Its Inclusivity Efforts. The University of Illinois should create a new vice chancellor to better coordinate wide-ranging and sometimes redundant efforts to promote diversity on campus, a new report says. The report from a team of outside reviewers, hired by Chancellor Robert Jones, also said a campus-wide diversity council should be appointed to organize numerous committees that have similar, if not overlapping, roles and operate with little collaboration. The council will report to the new Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, who would also develop a strategic plan for diversity and be accountable for efforts targeted at students, faculty, and staff, the report said. The reviewers said a more centralized structure could help the campus make significant progress in recruiting students, faculty, and employees from diverse backgrounds and providing a more inclusive campus. It's clear that we have a gap to close, and this report identifies tangible actions that will move us closer to our shared vision, Jones said in announcing the report Tuesday. More than 24 committees and offices already engage in diversity efforts were asked to do a self-study in advance of the reviewer's 2-day visit in February. The consensus was that a new model is needed, the report said. Based on its interviews, the review team concluded that the campus takes pride in its success of its diversity efforts and is clearly committed to the goal. It cited the Disability Resource and Educational Services Program and the Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations as strong examples. The campus spends about $60 million to promote diversity and inclusion, with 80% of it going towards student scholarships, according to the report. But it's unclear how that money is prioritized, how programs are assessed, or how units are held accountable, it said. Much of the work is decentralized, based on long-standing campus tradition, which is not necessarily detrimental, the report said. However, decentralization also leads to unnecessary redundancy, communication problems, and a lack of coordination. It makes it difficult to assess programs, the report said. Scattered acts of bias. The team said those interviewed cited concerns about funding and the lack of stability from recent turnover in the chancellor's and provost's offices. That was mentioned particularly by committees unsure whether administrators understood their role or could provide leadership to advance diversity in a coordinated way, the report said. The campus has had modest success in recruiting students of diverse backgrounds, with cultural centers playing a significant role, the report said. But with African American high school graduation rates decreasing, the U of I should reassess its recruiting strategies to attract diverse Illinois residents and students from varied socioeconomic backgrounds and explore stepped-up recruiting of non-resident minority students, the report said. Retention and graduation rates exceed national averages at the undergraduate level, which reviewers attribute to strong orientation, advising, and mentoring programs for underrepresented students. But those interviewed also raised concerns about students feeling isolated and at risk in light of scattered acts of bias throughout the campus. The new vice chancellor would share some functions of the vice chancellor for student affairs with the Office of Minority Student Affairs and an existing associate vice chancellor for inclusion and intercultural relations, reporting to both vice chancellors. The current associate chancellor for diversity, equity, and inclusion would be renamed to associate vice provost or associate vice chancellor and also report to the new vice chancellor for diversity. The review team recommended creating a comparable position focusing on student diversity. The Diversity Council would appoint subcommittees that would take on some of the roles of existing standalone committees, which appear to compete for limited resources and may have some concerns about turf, the report said. Four more steps to take. The review team also recommended a more thorough study to assess the climate and recruiting programs for diverse faculty groups, which said they often felt isolated professionally and personally on the campus. Postdoctorate programs offer great opportunities for increasing faculty diversity, but the transition to tenure system faculty has not been as successful, perhaps because of a lack of funding, the report said. It suggested a diversity research institute to bring diverse faculty together to enhance research and encourage interdisciplinary work. A review of the compliance and equity functions carried by multiple offices, such as disability resources, equal employment opportunity, and the Title IX and Americans with Disabilities Act coordinator, to ensure that campus interests are addressed, that money is allocated appropriately, and that they have what they need to carry out their responsibilities. A closer analysis of concerns of graduate students, given concerns about climate and alleged bias behavior on campus. A perceived lack of funding and support for minority students and those with families is affecting graduate student success and the desire for some to continue with Illinois, the report said. More resources for the system-wide program that promotes diversity among U of I suppliers and contractors. It is fundamentally sound, but could be more effective with additional staff and funding, and needs to place more emphasis on construction contracts, the report said. Team paid $6,500 plus. Jones requested the self-study and external review shortly after being named chancellor last fall. The review team included education professor Nancy Barcelo of Northern New Mexico College, Archie Irvin, vice president and chief diversity officer at Georgia Tech, Paulette Granberry Russell, director of the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives at Michigan State, and D. Craig Taylor, executive director of community planning and economic development for the city of Minneapolis. The review team was paid $6,500 plus travel and lodging, according to campus spokeswoman Robin Kaler. And also on the front page news from the state legislature, Senator Rose questions U of I budget priorities. Illinois needs more planning and coordination in its higher education system, State Senator Chapin Rose said Tuesday. Rose's remarks came after another nearly four-hour Senate committee hearing, where presidents of five state universities decried the ongoing budget impasse, which has led to staff layoffs, furloughs, enrollment losses, and faculty departures. Universities need to tout and expand on their strengths and eliminate weak and underperforming programs, said the Mahomet Republican. He was critical of the University of Illinois system for including in its capital plan an $83 million STEM building at its Springfield campus, while distributing a pamphlet lamenting reductions in rankings in some academic fields. Why are we funding a building for an unranked program when you've got the number 6 engineering school in the world that it could at least stay in the top 10 with that money? Rose said after the meeting. It's a matter of prioritization. He also hit the U of I for incomplete budget information on its website. He said there are full Orange Book operating budget documents online up to fiscal year 2015, but nothing after that. I've never seen an institution not tell you where the money is being spent. There is no transparency on how it's being spent, he said. But the secondary part is that, with whatever budget gets cobbled together here, are we funding our strengths, or are we subsidizing and coddling mediocrity and weakness? I mean, you can't see how it's all playing out. It's extremely hard to do that. It wasn't all bad for the U of I at Tuesday's hearing. Senator Andy Menar, Democrat of Bunker Hill, praised the university for its Investment Performance and Accountability Commitment, IPAC, which would exchange reliable funding for 5 years with a commitment to meeting certain performance metrics. So far, though, the legislation hasn't gone anywhere in the General Assembly. It's forward-thinking. It's putting all the cards on the table at a time when higher ed is facing its largest crisis in state history, Menar said. You could have waited until the budget crisis got solved, but you chose to put your head down and bring this forward. Meanwhile, other university presidents spoke of problems developing on their campuses. For this fall, and I know it's a little early to tell, but we've seen a downtick in the number of applications for the first time in a long time, and compared to last year, said Illinois State University President Larry Dietz. This is due to many things. One is just the overall demographic downtrend in the state of Illinois, and that we're in a bit of a trough. But there's also this crisis in confidence issue, with students going out of state. And Southern Illinois University President Randy Dunn said that his Carbondale campus is developing a financial sustainability plan that will be released around July 1st. Everything within the magnitude of operations we're going to be looking at, Dunn said, potentially making reductions or closing certain operations. Everything other than tenured faculty would be available for reorganization, restructuring, removing. Dunn said it's very challenging to remain open and honest about financial conditions at SIU without scaring away potential students. You can't run away from those facts and figures, but what we try to double down on then is the messaging we do around recruitment and retention. The message that we are not in a position where we'd ever see us have to close the doors, he said. We may look like a different institution. We may have to let some programs go and reconfigure others. We may not have as many people. Staffing will change. But from the standpoint of a 150-year history being lost, that's not going to happen. Finally, on the front page, we have the first in a series called Spotlight on College Grads. And here's the headline. He's gone above and beyond as an undergrad. St. Thomas More alum helped conduct research driving health bill in Georgia. In 10 days, Sean Monahan will receive a diploma from an engineering school ranked among the 5 best in America. But it's another high-stakes issue that has the Georgia Tech graduate-to-be a little distracted as commencement day draws near. In conjunction with his studies, the St. Thomas More alum has been working as an undergraduate researcher for a group hoping to influence healthcare legislation in the state of Georgia. Monahan recently helped conduct research for a bill that would increase access to dental hygiene services for low-income children who are on Medicaid and save the state money through preventive care in return. The legislation has cleared both the State House and the Senate and is in the hands of Georgia's governor awaiting approval. That whole experience, combing through data and recommending policy changes before he has even left campus, has been the highlight of Monahan's college experience, and it has made him a favorite among faculty at the elite Atlanta school, which ranks 7th in the U.S. News & World Report's ranking of the nation's top public universities. Illinois is 10th. Since my first encounter with Sean, he has distinguished himself as the type of student who is willing to go above and beyond in pursuit of knowledge, said Nicoletta Serban, an assistant professor in Tech's School of Industrial and Systems Engineering. He is particularly hardworking. The Road to Atlanta. Georgia Tech wasn't even on Monahan's radar when he started applying to colleges as a St. Thomas More senior. A native of Texas, his family moved to Champaign when he was in middle school. His father joined the family business, Monahan Filaments, in Arcola, and Sean attended St. Matthew School, then St. Thomas More. Athletics were a focal point for much of Monahan's high school career. He played 4 sports as well as competing on the high school math team. Sports ate up the majority of my time. I really missed the camaraderie of being on a team when I went to college, he said. Growing up about a mile from campus, Monahan said attending the U of I was never a consideration when he began school shopping. I really valued the idea of going off and living on my own and experiencing something new, he said. He applied to about 9 schools and eventually decided to submit an application for Georgia Tech after visiting the campus, a community filled with beautiful green space and all the benefits of really lively Midtown area, he said. He settled on industrial and systems engineering because of the reputation of that program at Tech, which has been the best in the world for years. I enjoyed every single class and fell in love with the coursework. I found it all really fascinating, so much so that I decided to do undergraduate research, which is rare for our program, and that's been a nice blessing for me, Monahan said. Serban, Sean stands out. The work he did for Health Analytics, the Georgia Tech group that bridges mathematical and statistical modeling with health services research, focused on the cost-effectiveness of dental procedures and people's access to Medicaid services. There are many dentists across the country, and a lot of them won't accept Medicaid, which poses a big access issue for people who try to go to the dentist for preventive care, but aren't close enough to one that accepts Medicaid, he said. So Monahan worked with a team that sought to determine the health and cost benefits of preventive dental care and how it could correlate into policy changes. Georgia House Bill 154 aims to allow hygienists to perform these services for people on Medicaid without a dentist present. If you allow a hygienist to do these procedures without dentist supervision, more people who need it most would have access to health-improving procedures, while also saving state Medicaid programs millions of dollars, he said. It's a win-win argument for states. Regardless of the outcome of the bill, the work Monahan did as an undergraduate student will take him far, Serban predicts. Sean stands out among our department's immense pool of talented learners. I anticipate that he will have a highly impactful career, she said. Next stop, Washington. In addition to his work at Health Analytics, Monahan won a string of undergraduate research and project awards the past 4 years. He also had the opportunity to work at a governmental consulting company when the Affordable Care Act was first rolling out. This was the year right when they were launching the website, which was a total failure, he said. That was one of the most interesting and crazy experiences, being at this company as a 19-year-old. We were working long hours, and I got to see a glimpse into how the working world is. It was cool to say I worked on and had a hand on that at a young age. Next for Monahan, while he seriously considered working toward his doctorate after graduation, he admits being really tired of school for now. So he is moving to Washington, D.C. this summer to do internal strategy work for Capital One. I wanted to do something strategy-oriented and felt that kind of role would suit me best for now. Instead of recommending policy decisions, I'll be recommending business decisions, he said. It'll be interesting to see how the company uses our research to make new products. I'm definitely a little scared because I don't know much about it, but I'm also excited. We'll move on to local news now. From the 13th District, we have the headline, Ammons says she's testing the water. Legislator starts committee to decide on run for Congress. State Representative Carol Ammons, Democrat of Urbana, announced Tuesday that she has formed an exploratory committee to decide whether to run in 2018 for Congress in Illinois' 13th District. You and I together are going to launch our exploratory committee together, she told hundreds of women and men outside the state capitol who were attending a Women March on Springfield rally. Over the next 2 months, I'll be visiting some of you in Bloomington Normal, Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, Edwardsville, and every town in between on a listening session. I want to hear directly from you. I want to speak to you. And I want to know what you and your families want out of your congresswoman, said Ammons, a 2-term state representative. Ammons is a former Champaign County board member and Urbana alderwoman, but she has never run outside of Champaign-Urbana. The 13th District, now represented by Republican U.S. Representative Rodney Davis of Taylorville, includes Champaign-Urbana and all or part of 13 other counties extending to the Illinois side of metropolitan St. Louis. Coincidentally, Deborah Bandy, Davis's sister and an organizer of the march and rally, was nearby when Ammons made her announcement. Ammons hit Davis for his support for repealing the Affordable Care Act and denying 35,000-plus people health care in the 13th Congressional District, and said that Davis should hold town hall meetings with constituents. "Don't be afraid," she said. Ammons said she would listen to people over the next 2 months to hear what they want and see if what we're offering is what they want. A two-month deadline would give Ammons until shortly before July 4th to decide whether to run. "I'm trying to be realistic about what the timeline is. I enjoy doing the policy work that I have here in Springfield, but I've gotten thousands of emails and calls asking me to consider running," she said. "Forming an exploratory committee," she said, "gives us an opportunity to sort of test the waters and see what the people of the district want." It also allows her to not have to register with the Federal Elections Commission or to file reports with the FEC, even if she raises $5,000 or more. But once she files as a candidate, she must report those contributions. Ammons has been a successful legislative fundraiser, reporting more than $120,000 in her state campaign fund as of March 31st. She said she was not certain that she would run. "I don't have a percentage. It's an exploratory. So I don't know what's going to happen at this point," she said. Ammons said that the fundraising response in the next 2 months is important, but that's not the focal point for me at this point. She said that Bloomington physician David Gill, who has run in the district before and already has announced he is running in 2018, would not be a factor in her decision. "I'm looking at it as a person who is trying to measure it out for myself, not really concerned about other people who may be looking at it," Ammons said. Within minutes of her announcement, the Illinois Republican Party issued a statement about Ammons, calling her Bernie's candidate. She supported Senator Bernie Sanders for president last year, and saying that she was a socialist. The battle lines have been drawn as Bernie-backed Carol Ammons announces her long-shot bid for Illinois 13 in an attempt to bring her socialist views to Washington. Ammons will be facing off against Pelosi-backed David Gill in what is sure to be a race to the radical left, said Aaron DeGroot, a spokesman for the state GOP. With candidates like these, Democrats are once again proving they are out of touch with central Illinois values. We have a teacher of the week today. The headline is, "Very little I want to do, I haven't already done." Meet Gary Pinkerton, an educator at Edison Middle School, who teaches 7th grade social studies, language arts, and enrichment classes. Pinkerton, 66, became a teacher after deciding to go back to graduate school in his late 30s. He's retiring at the end of next month after teaching at Edison for 20 years, and said he plans to spend his newfound free time relaxing and doing the activities he enjoys. "I read a lot. I own 2 kayaks. I belong to Planet Fitness. I like outdoor activities. I have 3 cats and a dog that require much attention. I've already lived all over the country. I have no great desire to travel and live out of a suitcase. There is very little I want to do that I haven't already done," he said. Here are his questions. What do your students like most about you? I've never asked them, but they might say my humor would be one thing. Also, I don't pretend to know things when I don't, and I admit when I make mistakes. Favorite tactics for getting students to pay attention? I stand quietly, tap on one of the front desks. I'm not adverse to raising my voice if necessary. I also have a police whistle. Teaching supply you can't live without. There's nothing I can't live without. I like technology, but I've been around long enough to have taught without it. Funniest question a student has ever asked you? If I were the same age as a fellow teacher who is 30 years younger than I am. Who was one of your favorite teachers growing up? Mrs. Oliver, who taught senior government. She was no-nonsense and kind of a tyrant, but she respected a good argument and a point of view with facts behind it. Favorite hobby? Reading. Lesson plan you're most proud of. This year, during the presidential election, my classes spent over a month learning about the individual candidates and issues. They researched individual candidates and their platforms. They learned all about the Electoral College and what is allowed and not allowed by our Constitution. I felt I was actually making a difference with this lesson. Subject or topic you like teaching the best? Anything to do with Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. I had more than 10 relatives who fought for the North, and one great-grandfather who died during the Civil War. Also, anything involving politics. What's the best part of your job? What's the most difficult? Best part of the job, working with children. Most difficult part of the job, working with and dealing with adults who behave like children. Classroom pet peeve? Being tardy, not having materials, and being unpleasant to me or others. In news from the Urbana Community Development Commission, we have City may join Urban Blight Mitigation Program. The city could be joining in the Illinois Housing Development Authority's Abandoned Property Program to receive $71,000 for residential plots. The program provides financial aid for maintaining, securing, and clearing vacant, non-commercial properties. Urbana's Community Development Commission unanimously approved the city's participation Tuesday, and the City Council will vote on it Monday. Funding for the program comes from Abandoned Residential Property Municipality Relief Fund money, according to a city memorandum. If the city is approved to participate in the program, it would be involved for no more than 2 years and would have to spend all of its funds within that time. Kelly Murkowski, the city's Grants Management Division Manager, said the fund would be available after July 1st. The city is currently proposing that these funds be used for reimbursement of costs already expended to maintain lots on which abandoned properties have already been demolished, for future property maintenance activities, and for demolition of blighted and abandoned properties in the city, according to the memorandum. Other funding purposes the IHDA allows with the program are trimming overgrown vegetation, pest control, boarding up and closing the property off. Urbana applied to the program in October 2016 and was notified of its eligible funding this February. And from Monticello, hospital expansion gets go-ahead. City Council members gave their blessing to a variance needed for Kirby Medical Center to launch a $12.5 million expansion effort at the Monticello Hospital. Kirby CEO Steve Tenhouse told aldermen a 16,500-square-foot addition to the east, along with a planned remodel of 17,000 square feet of the existing 2011 hospital building, are needed to accommodate the expansion of the therapy and Kirby Medical Group departments. There's a ripple effect when you grow these two departments and start displacing areas, so then you've got to move things around, said Tenhouse, pointing out that the number of Kirby Medical Group exam rooms will grow from 3 to 6, and that the building addition will also accommodate a larger therapy department. The zoning variance, approved unanimously by the council, allows a reduction in the hospital's side yard setback to 0. Kirby already had such a variance for a breezeway that currently connects it with the adjacent Carl Clinic, but that was project-specific, so another approval was needed. The building addition, which will also house a relocated lab department as well as several office spaces, will come within 20 feet of Carl. An enclosed, climate-controlled hallway will bridge the gap. Next for the hospital is obtaining a building permit from the city, then securing the borrowing needed to fund the construction. Tenhouse said he hopes to break ground on the three-phase project in October and have it completed by February of 2019. In a quick look at history, on April 26th in 1777, according to a widely accepted account from the American Revolutionary War, 16-year-old Sybil Luddington, the eldest child of Colonel Henry Luddington, a militia commander in Dutchess County, New York, rode her horse into the night to alert her father's men of the approach of British regular troops who were sacking Danbury, Connecticut. Luddington is sometimes referred to as the female Paul Revere and was said to have covered 40 miles, more than twice the distance of the Boston silversmith's ride. We'll take a quick break now and then come back with the second half hour of the News Gazette for Wednesday, April 26, 2017. Please stay tuned.